were discussing last week, Onas Dvorim. And let me just retrace a little bit to where we were holding and what has to be explained. We said there's a concept of Onaa, which applies to monetary things. That's Onas Mama. Onas Mama means you cheat somebody. Either the buyer or the seller cheats the other. It can be that somebody sells something that's worth $10 and he makes as if it's worth $20 and he sells, overcharges. That's Onaa. Or the opposite. Somebody buys something and fools the person who's selling it into thinking that it's not worth so much and he sells it for less than it's worth. That's Onas Mama. Chazal learned that there's also an idea of Onas Dvorim. Same idea, Onaa. Right, somehow cheating, but it's not monetary, it's verbal. So what are the examples of that? So some of the examples fit very nicely. It's exactly the same thing, except instead of being monetary, it's brought about more verbally. The classic case of Onas Dvorim that fits the model perfectly is where you cheat somebody by making them think you're a customer and you're not. Right? You bought a dress yesterday in one place and you pass by a store and see that they're selling the exact same dress. You have no interest in buying this exact same dress again, but you want to know if you got a good deal. So you want to go in and ask them how much the dress is. So you know if you got a good deal the day before. And you'd rather not tell them that you just want to price it, because then they have the option of giving you a ridiculously low price and making you feel terrible. Right. So you appear to be a customer. You have no intention. If you have intention, maybe if it's a good price, you'll buy it. Then it's okay to do this. But if there's, you have no chance you'll ever buy that dress. Okay, unless they give it to you for free, and even then, you don't want two dresses the same thing. So you ask, you make it believe you're a customer, and you ask as if you're asking about the dress that you want to buy. That's Onas Dvorim. I understand that. You're cheating them by making them believe that you're a customer, and you're cheating them out of their time, their expectations, whatever it may be, and they could do something better with their time if they knew that you're a spam. If you tell them, no, I only want to know the price, right? I'm not really interested right now in buying the dress. I may be interested in the future, which could be if the first dress gets burnt or something, you may want to buy a second one. So it is possible. Then what's it called? Or I'm shopping around. That you're allowed to do. As long as they know that you're not a immediate customer. Okay, that fits. But there are other examples of Onas Dvorim that don't seem to fit the model. That stands to be just hurting people, not cheating them necessarily. For instance, the Gemara says, Onas Ishto, is where you hurt your wife's feelings. The Gemara said, the husband has to be very careful at that, because if your husband causes your wife to cry, it can be very dangerous to the husband's health. Another case is where you tell a Baal Tshuva or a Ger, right, to hurt them. Remember when you used to eat treif, right? Remember when you were a goy? Right, in order to hurt them, not to say, wow, remember what you used to be and now look at the way you are now, and the person, Adarabha, feels it's a COVID, that's not that awesome. But you're doing it to hurt them. But there, it doesn't seem to be you're cheating them of anything. You're, what's it called? You're hurting their feelings. Why is that called Onas Dvorim? Should be called, I don't know, Malbin Pnei Chaveiro, it could be called, I don't know, a million other things, but why is it called cheating? What's the Onaa over there? That's the problem. The same thing goes, or telling somebody in the hospital, right, oh, you must have done some pretty, really bad sins, because otherwise you wouldn't be sick like you are now, right, because God doesn't do anything that's unjust, and you probably deserve being sick, right, that you don't tell somebody who's sick that. It's true, right, the Rebbe doesn't make people sick unless something's wrong with them. That's what Chavrei Iyuv said. If you do that, you're over on Onas Dvorim. So again, you hurt the guy's feelings, but why is that Onaa? So I have two ways of explaining this, and Batya sent me a third way, which I'm not 100% sure what she meant, so I'll let her speak for herself. Okay? In fact, you can go first.
So what What I said was that with a husband and a wife, when you give the ketubah, then there's a, it's a written promise, but it's certainly a promise that you're going to treat.
It's written. It's written in the ketubah. Nobody ever knows what that ketubah is, but it says, "Ana okir, I will respect the Azon and support, or whatever." So just like people don't support, they don't respect the Azon. But it goes. The truth is, it goes together, because the Gemara says that one of the ways of getting good parnasa is respecting your wife. A person respects his wife is zoche that the parnasa comes to the home through the woman. And if the woman is more respectable, so she's a greater magnet for parnasa. So the Gemara says, Rava told his Talmidim, respect your wife so you'll make a good parnasa. So so they go together. I will respect you, and the male, I'll be able to support you. Yeah.
So she then has it, and then when it comes to some, or Yehudim, they're raving there, and I think they're known as chaver and not, you know, there's a closer kesher there. So there's an expectation, it's almost a chiyuv on the part of each person to treat someone in a correct way. So if you treat them in an incorrect way, you're cheating them of their right to be treated correctly.
Okay, that sounds like an interesting idea. Okay, well, I'm going to tell you it's a little more complicated, but it sounds like it's possible. That every time you hurt somebody, right, either... whatever way, you're breaking a contract that you're supposed to not treat them like that. So you're cheating them out of their rights. That's the basic idea, yeah?
Right.
Okay.
And then Tzipora said, because we were discussing...
That what?
Tzipora.
Yeah? I don't know any Tziporas. Yeah, okay, yeah. Poey, yeah?
Said, yeah. said that each time you do treat someone disrespectfully... then you're reducing their own confidence in themselves, their own you're making them have a problem about their, so again you're cheating them
of something that they deserve.
Their
you're cheating them out of their feeling of accomplishment, whether it's a baltshuva that they now.
What happened to the guy in the hospital?
Also, to go and say that you must have done some great averas to deserve this one. Like,
feeling yourself.
No, I've accomplished it, you know, and also with a husband to his wife. She wants to feel like an Ashes child in his eyes, and, you know, and he hurts her feelings, then it's going to feel like that. Like, I think there's
you're cheating her out of her self-respect, self-esteem, whatever, or
that's
contractual. Could be. Could be. I'll tell you two more things that are not so simple. That are... First one is the one I usually said. I think the second one is more to the inyan, even though I hear what you're saying, it also could be an idea. The first one is the following. The isser of onah is not necessarily the major thing is that you make somebody else lose something. Okay, even with the monetary thing. Because it's interesting halacha that it could be that onas mamon is usser even to a goy. You can't cheat a goy, okay? Not a Jew. Yet there is an opinion that says that you're allowed to steal from a goy. We don't pass them like that. Don't get your hopes up. Okay? But there is an opinion that gneivas akum, gzeilas akum is mutter. Yet it's mashma that even the mandiomer who holds that gzeilas akum is mutter, onas, advarim by a goy is osir. So how could that be? If you're allowed to steal from the guy, why aren't you allowed to cheat from him? That's even less of a, you know, it's more roundabout. That means that the main thing is not what you're taking away from the person. It's something else. What is that something else? So the first way of explaining it is the following. Everything that's real in this world is what's emes. And the Rabbanu Shlom is emes, Hashem Elokeichem emes. And he created a real world. But he also created a fantasy world. That's called the Olam HaSheker. That's the world of evil. It doesn't really exist. It just appears to exist. Okay? It's all basically in your imagination. The Beis Halevi says that that's the meaning of the following Gemara. The Gemara says that Lasid Lava Kodesh Baruch Hu is going to take the Satan and shecht him, and he's going to appear in front of the Tzaddikim and in front of the Rishayim. To the tzaddikim, he's going to look like a big bout, and to the rishayim, like a hair's breadth. And they're both going to be crying. the tzaddikim are going to be crying, how did we conquer this mountain? And they're going to be crying out of joy, according to some, right? Wow, look what we accomplished. And the Rishonim are going to say, how come we couldn't conquer this little hair's breadth? They're going to be crying and bemoaning their fate, that all we had to do is conquer this little hair's breadth. So he explains that the major Yetzer Hara in this world is imagination. It doesn't really, it's not really, really existent. It's an Olam HaShekhar. And the truth to that is that usually you fantasize an Avera to be a lot better than it actually is. Example, okay, when something's treif, right, and you imagine that, you know, what it would be like to eat this really, really good treif thing. And then they make it kosher. And then you eat it. And you realize that no big deal, right? It's not as good as it looked when it was awesome. So most of the Avera is imagination. Okay. So it's a hard as an ability to create an image, a false image. And if that's hard to understand, that there can be things in this world that look real, but they're really not real. They're just imagined. They're just apparitions. They're an Olam HaSheker. That's why Sheker has three letters that are right next to each other, Shin, Kuf, and Resh, in the opposite order, descending order, and they all come to one point or one leg. They don't have a leg to stand on. They're not real. They're imagined. And Emes, on the other hand, is broad. From the beginning of the Aleph base to the end, Aleph Mem is the middle, Tuf is the end, and they all stand on two legs or on a base. It has a base. It has substance. It's substantive. If you want to see that, the fall of the Soviet Union is a perfect example of something that looked substantive and strong, and that would be around for who knows how long. The only way to destroy it was with, you know, atomic bombs, and one day it was here and one day it just disappeared. There was no more Soviet Union. Just disappeared overnight, like it says in the davening on Rosh Hashanah, the Chol Harisha Kula Ke'oshan Tichla. The example I always love to give of how there can be a world that looks very real, but is an Olam HaSheker, is Disney World. When Disney World opened up in Florida, in Orlando, I was still in Miami then, so I took my kids and Chol HaMoed Pesach to see Disney World. The whole thing wasn't open. The Epcot Center wasn't open. It was just a regular, like, Disneyland, and that was what was open there. So they have a place there called the Hall of Presidents. What they have is they have robots, mamish robots that were that was how many years ago? That was 30, 40 years ago. Now it's probably 30 years ago. It was, about 35 years ago. In any case, so they must have, you know, have an even better today with computerized, digitalized things. But even then, they were mamish computer-controlled robots that sweated, grimaced, walked up and down, what's it called, they had facial expressions. They had all the presidents of the United States from George Washington till then, I think it was Jimmy Carter. And they were on a stage. And each one was doing his little thing, what's it called, walking around. You could see they mamish looked like real human beings. If you didn't know that it was robots, you would think it was so lifelike, it was unbelievable. So I remember I went into this thing with Shimmy, who at the time was probably about 5 or 6 years old. And he looks up at these people on the stage. He says, Tati, are those real people? I said, no, they're just a bunch of dummies. That was not really the thing to say because they have really not nice looks, like, you know, what are you, insulting the president? That really was true, but in any case, they're just a bunch of robots, dolls, dummies, they're not real. So I see that he starts to think deeply, right? He's like lost in thought. It took about 3-4 minutes. He looks up to me, he says, Tati, is this chair real? Right? He wasn't sure anymore what's real. If they aren't real, then I'm not sure what's real anymore. I'm sure the next question was, are you real? Right now, it's his whole, you know, like, trust in the reality of the world has been shaken, because if that's not real, I don't know what's real anymore. That's the Metzius. My Shabbos Drosha, Shabbos Chol HaMoed, was about that. So that you can have an Olam, God gave Walt Disney, Olam HaShalom, the ability to create a world of fantasy. And it looks really real. Right? If you never were there, you can't appreciate what an Olam HaSheker is. And that way people can see. You can have something that looks real, but it's not real. It's just a bunch of, it's a fantasy. That's Olam HaSheker. And therefore, a person in this world, if you create a false impression, you are basically like a being over the Avodah Zorah. That's why it compares El Noah to Avodah Zorah. And it says that the Rebbe took us out of Egypt, and one of the conditions was we're not over on this El Noah. It's the whole inyan of Yetzias Mitzrayim, the whole inyan of Torah, is to separate fact from fiction, reality, right, death from life. Death is non-existence. Ra is bad, is non-existence. Right? Bracha, klala, all of that, all the things that are negative are really non-existent. So our chiyuv in this world is to present what is real and what's true, and not to create false impressions and more falsehood in the world. So the inyan of Onoah is creating a false impression. It's not so much that I took $20 from you because I said that this book is a rare book and I sold it to you for $100, it's only worth $20. So I cheated you out of $80. It's not the $80 that's the ikar. It's that I created a false image and made you believe that this thing is something it isn't. And in doing that, I basically supported evil in the world because evil is falseness. And I created something that's not that against the Rebbe's one. The Rebbe's one is MS and this is false. So in any situation where I create a false impression, that is onas mamon, and that's onas devarim. Therefore, if I create the impression that I'm a customer, it's not usher because I'm taking away your time or whatever. That may be a secondary thing. It's usher because I made a false impression that I'm a customer. I'm not a customer. That's what's usher. The same thing goes, I go to the hospital and tell somebody, you wouldn't be sick if you weren't, like the friends told Eve, unless you're really a faker, right? You look like you're from, but you couldn't be because you would be sick like this if you were. That causes a false impression. That the only sick people in this world are chatzlaim. That's true. There's a million reasons why people could be sick. Could be a person with a big tzaddik, and because of that, the Rebbeinu Shel Olam is paying more for his averus in this world, so he get the whole next world. It's the opposite. It's because he's a great tzaddik. There are a million different reasons why people suffer. Not only because they're fakers. Right? Not everybody, the great tanoim suffered, Bikiva suffered, because he was a faker, because other rabbi, because he was on a very, very high madrega, and the Rebbeinu was paying him for his averus in this world, so he'd have a total olam haba. So, you're creating false impression, that anybody who suffers, who's sick, is a sinner and a faker. That's a false impression.
But remember when you were a goy?
A ger has no connection to his previous life. Gershon is Geyer, Kekotten, Shanolid. He's a newborn person. If I tell him, remember you used to eat tray, that's not true. You are from the time you were the Geyer. What happened before is a different person. Balchuva, the same thing. Ein maskirim lo. It's like you're a newborn person. If I say, remember what you did in your previous life, that means that I'm giving the impression that that's you. You're the same person you were before. Right? So that's not true. That was a different person. That was the person before the tshuva. That was the person before the gavis. You're giving the impression that you're the same person. The same thing goes with husband and wife. A husband and wife are supposed to be like one person. Ishto kegufo balkisho. There's got to be a lot of halachas of testimony of a million things. Husband and wife are like the Chazon Ish says, like the right hand and left hand of the same body. Right? The famous Maisa with Ari Levi. Right? That my wife's leg hurts us. You have to feel that you're like one being. So a husband who hurts his wife's feelings is giving the impression, you don't go hurt yourself, right? You don't stand in front of a mirror and insult yourself, unless you're schizophrenic or really off the wall. Right? But normal people don't do that, right? You don't go and hurt yourself, break your leg or whatever, right? People don't want to hurt themselves unless they're sick, okay? They're masochists or whatever. But normal people don't do that. So if you hurt your wife, that means you're giving the impression that she is not part of you. That's a false impression. She is part of you. So you're creating a false impression. All of these things fit that model, and if that's what the basis of Onas Devarim is, then it fits the model of Onas Devarim. Onas Devarim means You are, just like regular cheating, you are creating a false impression. That is what I've said in the past, and I still think it holds water, but not 100%. I'm not going to tell you why, because I don't have to be on over on Nas Dvarma myself, but in any case, there are reasons why it doesn't, it's not 100% right. I found the Gemara in Matzia that it's mashma a little bit, that if you hold that Onas Dvarim, that Gezel Akum was mutter, then Onas Akum was also mutter. Not clear, I have a way of getting out of it, but in any case, it lives mashma a little like that. If that's the case, then my whole thing falls away. At least the proof. Okay, in any case, the whole thing doesn't fall away, but it's, that makes it much more strong. Okay, in any case, I have another idea I was thinking of, and I think this is more simple and more to the fact, and I'm asking that what both of you said also is possible, more simple and to the fact.
I think in what we said before was taking away the feeling of, whereas the Rav is saying it's taking away the reality.
Right, exactly, right. Okay, there's another idea, though, of cheating, and that's the following. Let me preface it with another vort that has relevance to it. We'll see. The when Moshe Rabbeinu came to Paro the first time, so he said, "We want to go 3 days in the desert and sacrifice, and that's what we're asking for." Now that was a lie, because the Rambam told Moshe Rabbeinu very clearly that he wants to take him out of Mitzrayim and take him to Eretz Israel for good. They don't want to go 3 days in the desert and come back. Even though he didn't say we're coming back, it gave that impression. So the kasha is, why did the Ribbono Shel Olam tell Moshe Rabbeinu to lie? So there's all different answers. One is that he wanted Paro to have free choice. Right? He didn't want to force him, right? And if he said, we're going for good, he would never have free choice. He would have to say no. That's an offer that he couldn't possibly agree to. So you start with him with 3 days, then maybe he says yes, mitzvah, go eretz mitzvah. If he said yes to this, you get him to that. That's how you negotiate, you know. Negotiations. That's one answer. But the Ramban says it was in order to punish him. And he wanted to drown them because they drowned our children. So he had to get them to the Yamsuf. He couldn't send them an invitation. Could you please be at the Yamsuf on this and this day, at this and this time, I'd like to drown you. Right? Wouldn't work. So how is he going to get Paro to go to the Yamsuf? So he made this whole intricate, the Ribbono Shel Olam, fabrication, that they want to go 3 days and finally let them out and send people to see they're coming back, and then they're not coming back. He ran after them and then he gets drowned. Okay? So it was all in order to be able to punish him. That's what the Ramban says. The only thing, the Ramban is very difficult, because God couldn't think of any other way to get Paro to the Yam Suf, right, except by lying to him. Right? Especially after what we said, that lying, that's called being connected to the Ribbono Shel Olam or whatever. Why would the Ribbono Shel Olam lie? So they could bring the Yam Suf to them. He could drown him in the Nile. He could drown him in their bathtub. I mean, there's a million things that Ramban can do. If he wants to drown him, he doesn't have to take him to the Yam Suf. So the Or HaChaim HaKadosh adds a dimension to this Ramban. And he says that was part of the punishment. God wanted to punish him, Mida K'neged Mida. In other words, you drowned our children, we're going to drown you. But there was another aspect to what he did. Paro didn't come just and drown children and enslave the Jewish people. He fooled them into becoming slaves. Perach, right? Gemara Medrash says that what's it called? He came and he said, we have to build cities, you know, for Mitzrayim, and we need volunteers, and what's it called? And you'll be paid. And so in the beginning, a lot of Egyptians came and Jews came, and they paid them, you know, to work for the building these store cities. And then one day they said, you know, we don't really have any more money. We want now people to volunteer. So the Egyptians left. Jews are always more patriotic, you know, they want to show that they're really patriotic. They stayed. No, now they're working for nothing, right? Building these cities. All of a sudden, one day they come, and somebody taps them on the back and says, why were you late? He says, what do you mean late? I volunteered for this. He says, no, from now on, you have to show up on time, and you can't leave until we say you can leave. So little by little, they enslave them in this way, in with guile, with subterfuge, right? Perach. With a soft tongue. They fooled them. So part of the punishment had to be that Paro should know what it likes to be fooled. Right? To feel like a fool. It wasn't good enough just to drown him. He had to be drowned and feel like a fool. He was had. Right, you know, he was fooled that they're coming back and he had to chase after them, and then Paro was punished in kind. Not only was he punished to suffer, he was also punished to be had. Just like he made the Jews feel like fools, he had to be make the people feel like fools. That's what the Aruch Haim HaKadosh says. See from that, that there's a special thing, aside from losing money, aside from feeling bad, but there's an idea of feeling that you've been had. You've been taken advantage of. It's not just fooled. There's another aspect to that. And that is taking advantage of somebody's weakness. Right? Then a person really feels that they've been like, what's a good word? They've been taken advantage of. What? Yeah, taken advantage of. And all the cases, I didn't tell you all the cases of Onas Devarim. One of them is taking Gisomim, right, little orphans, and hurting them. Okay? And the Chinuch says, if you're doing it, however, for a good purpose, to educate these kids, then it's okay. But Stam, to hurt them because they're vulnerable people, right, and they're easy to take advantage of, that's Ona. That sheds light on all the other cases. All the other cases is somebody is in a position where they're vulnerable, and you take advantage of that vulnerability. Okay, here's a person in a store looking for customers. You know, he sits on there sometimes. You know, nobody ever walks into the store or whatever. Suddenly, somebody came into the store. You build up their expectations, and you have them where you want them because they know that maybe in Israel it doesn't really apply, right? Because people in Israel, they give you the feeling if you walk into the store, why are you bothering me? Like, you know, I was very happy here and there's nobody here and I was sipping my coffee and having my 15th coffee break for the day. And you're like, you know, what are you coming in here for? The even if people own the store, let alone the people who work there, feel like that. But in normal places in the world, right, people look for, wow, what's it called? Somebody came into my store, right, a customer. I'm taking advantage of their vulnerability, right? I'm taking advantage of them. A wife, what's it called, is to a certain degree subservient to her husband, to a certain degree. And I'm taking advantage of your weakness and hurting you. A yosom, right? It says by a person who hurts, an almana or a yosom, it says, the haya ki tzok yitzak elai, they'll cry to me, double, right? Also, if you will oppress them, double. They'll call to me double. Right? Shamoa Eshma, I'll listen and I'll take care of you too. So one of the ideas by this double is, if you hurt them, if you hurt a normal person, you hurt them. But if you hurt them, they're realize that they're vulnerable because they don't have a husband, they don't have a father, right? And they're vulnerable. And it reminds them that they're weak and vulnerable, and that's why you think you can take advantage of them. So you're hurting them twice. You're hurting them what they hurt, and you're bringing up the fact that it hurts them that they're. If I had a father, you wouldn't do this to me. If I had a husband, you wouldn't do this to me. So you're taking advantage of their weakness. That's the idea. You're taking advantage of their vulnerability. Same thing with a ger, right? A ger feels insecure or whatever. And you're hurting him because you're taking advantage of his insecurity, of his vulnerability. Same thing with a Baal Tshuva. All these cases is somebody, that's called cheating. Cheating means, because you're ignorant, you don't know anything about Svarim. So I can tell you that this Sefer, right, this Chumash is really, right, it's like, you know, 3,000 years old and it's, what's it called? That's true, but not this edition. Right. And therefore, you really should give me $100, I'm giving you a real bargain. And the thing's worth $5. So, I'm taking advantage of your vulnerability, your weakness, that you don't know, you're not too business, smart in this area. So I'm taking advantage of your weakness. That's what I know is. That's cheating. Cheating means, I took advantage of your ignorance, I took advantage of your weak situation, of your being subordinate, right? You're under my clutches. I'm in that store, and you want customers. I'm taking advantage of that weakness that you have and taking advantage of you. That's the idea of cheating. That's onoha. I think that really captures it more than any of the other things that were said. But all of them could be true. They're all aspect of this thing, but I think that that's an idea of onas dvarim. Any questions, comments, or yeah?
So, according to this, why should there be a difference between regular merchandise and karkot?
Yeah, that's according to most opinions. Okay, there's an iser onoa even on karkot. The only thing is that the mekach's not bought, right? Or it could be. Right? Even according to those opinions. So according to that, there's no question. Okay. According to the opinions that say, what Rafael's referring to is the halach of cheating when it comes to money only applies to movable property, books, whatever, right? Doesn't apply to land. If I sell you a house, real estate, and I tell you that houses in Matit Yo are worth $5 million, when they're not worth that much, they're almost like that. I'm not, you know, not exactly like that. It's a little bit inflated. So there, the issur doesn't apply, and the sale is still a sale. Some hold it's up till double the amount, more than that already. Even by real estate, it applies, but double the amount, till double the amount, pretty much doesn't apply. So there's two opinions. One says that you transgress the prohibition of cheating the person, but the sale is still a sale. And others hold you don't transgress it at all. So according to the one that you transgress it, the question is no question. Why doesn't it apply to real estate? According to all these reasons, are you taking advantage of the person's ignorance? You're creating a false impression. You have a contractual idea with people to treat them properly, and you're treating them improperly, whatever it may be. But the truth is that there's a reason behind it. Because real estate doesn't have any set value. It fluctuates, as we know, right? From you could make millions in real estate, or you could the next day, right? The property value could go down. It's not like a movable thing. It has a certain range, right? But it's not going to plummet unless, you know, like a film, right? Something is made and there's no more market for a film. I don't think anybody sells film anymore, right? Because everything is digital cameras. So more people don't sell records anymore, or now even bulbs. You can't even get a light bulb anymore, right? You have to get these, whatever, right? So Lamaisa, right, incandescent bulbs, I think it's against the law to sell them now, yeah? Anything more than 60 watts. That's what I saw. That's terrible. I love those. What?
I just went yesterday to buy 100 watts. They told me they're not selling anything more than 60 now.
What?
The,
in any case. So, that's an exception. But normal things, land, taka, can fluctuate. It doesn't have a set value. It depends really on a lot of factors that can make it go from who knows what to what. And what gold is like that too, but okay. But in any case, so that could be the reason. It's not false. It's real, right? What the market value is creates the value of that thing. Unlike things that are movable, the value of the thing. I'll tell you, I really know what I'm talking about, because I don't know too much about the. But it makes sense to me. I'm just afraid that David's going to ask me a question, and he knows about these things. Kosher came where he doesn't know about it. He asked me a question where he knows about it. I'm really afraid. And I don't know. So I'm trying to buffer the opposition that I could see is coming soon. But I admit I don't know what I'm talking about, but it does make some sense. Okay.
The Rebbe mentioned negotiations before. So professional negotiators, whether they're in the political arena or labor contracts or whatever, and both sides know that they're just opening with a certain whatever position, and knowing that that's not really what they're going for. How does that fit in?
That's okay. No, because that, you know, in the end, you're not causing any result. This is just a way to get to the happy medium, right? The Gemara says, a mocher always says, tov tov tov, and the kolkechos is ra ra, right? So this thing isn't worth 10 cents, right? Right. This is worth 10 cents. And the other guy said this is worth $1 million, and somehow they come to a, you know, in Eretz Yisrael, that's for sure the way. Remember when we started sending our kids to Yisodot? First we came here, it was the only one option, sent to Shalavim. And some people weren't happy with that or whatever. So we decided we're going to give two options. And whoever wants to consent to Yisodot, whoever wants to continue, send to Shalavim. So we asked the Moitza for a Hasa'ah to Yisodot. And they refused us hands down. No way. They didn't want sending our kids to Yisodot for a million different reasons. Out of their Moitza, it's out of their world of Hashkofa or whatever. They didn't want us sending to Yisodot, if you remember, and they refused to give us a Hasa'ah. And we went, I think Batya was involved then too, for sure. We went there and we begged and we asked, and every office just slammed the door in our face, and this is not possible, and, you know, forget it or whatever. Who are you anyway? We have 11 families over here. You want a Hasa'ah to Yisodot? It's money, whatever. And what happened was, I drove the Hasa'ah for about 2 weeks. I drove the kids to Yisodot. I became a bus driver. And then when they saw that we meant business and we were sending the kids no matter what, then all of a sudden they said, okay, we'll give you Hasa'ah. So I remember asking the head of the Moitza, the head of that committee, whoever it was at the time, I said, if you knew in the end that you were going to give us the Hasa'ah, why did you make it so hard for us? He says, well, that's the way it works in this country. We say no, no, no until you slam us on the table, and then we say yes. He said, you better learn that. That's the way it works over here, otherwise you get nothing. So, okay, so that's the way it works. That's called negotiations, I guess. They never meant to say no, they just meant to say no until you'll make a case of it. So make a case. If you don't make a case, then you're stupid, whatever. So that's not really false. Everybody knows that, you know, it's like the United Nations. Everybody knows who gets up there is lying. And the guy who's lying knows that everybody knows that he's lying. And they know that he knows that they know that he's lying. Nobody cares.